Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. In August 1939, as the threat of war loomed ominously over Europe, curators worked feverishly to protect not only the Mona Lisa, but other masterpieces housed in the Louvre. The story of how the world's most famous painting and other precious works of art survived the Second World War and the Nazi occupation is recounted in the book Saving Mona Lisa, The Battle to Protect the Louvre and Its Treasures During World War II. It is a sweeping, suspenseful narrative detailing how the museum staff managed to protect the country's artistic heritage from Hitler and his henchmen, and it's written by my guest today. Jerry Chanel first learned of this massive undertaking while watching a documentary about the Louvre. An international business consultant, prize-winning journalist, college professor, and lifelong Francophile, Jerry lived in Paris for 5 years, where she not only taught accounting and management courses at several colleges, but also acted on her passion for French cuisine, starting a small wine and cheese business called Paris on Your Plate. However, it was during that time that Jerry began researching her book. She spent endless hours combing through French archives, some of them recently accessible thanks to the passage of time and new legislation, and she was also able to interview the few living witnesses. As Jerry says, research is research, whether it's writing an article about a new tax law, learning about different cheeses, or putting together all the pieces of the biggest evacuation of art and antiques in history. Jerry, welcome, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Sandy. Nice to be here.
Let's begin with your fascination for all things French. How did that happen?
My father's brother married a woman who was born and raised in Paris, and she had a gigantic influence on my life from the time I was very small. I grew up in Connecticut. We would come to New York City, and everything about their home and about her accent, about the way she served food at the table was fascinating. So I was obsessed with everything French from a very young age.
Did you go over as a youngster to visit?
No, I always had a fantasy about going to France, but at the same time, I was afraid about going far from home. I had wanted to be an exchange student in high school and college, but yet I couldn't make myself do it. I did not, after a lifetime of fantasizing about Paris. I did not get to Paris till April 2000.
When you were far from a teenager.
Correct.
Or a college student. It's interesting, though, that you never thought about maybe majoring in French when you went to college.
I should have, in retrospect. The problem that I, or the frustration I had in high school, was that we learned to read great literature. So we learned to read, and we learned to read in a literary tense. We did not learn how to have conversations. And so I thought, well, I don't want 4 more years of that. But ironically, it's at college level French that you actually learn how to speak French.
So how did you come to get involved with business?
I had no idea what I wanted to major in. I majored in, I thought I would be an optometrist one semester. I thought I would be a teacher one semester. I had no idea. But at one point, when I was a psychology major, I needed a part-time job, and I saw a little ad on a bulletin board at school that said, small accounting firm looking for part-time clerk typist. And I could type very quickly, so I got hired at the accounting firm. And within several weeks, I started doing accounting-related things. I had a knack for it. It came very easily to me. And I was also very lucky that I had a boss. I started in October, and he saw some potential for help during tax season. So he gave me a book about taxes and gave me an assignment every week. And then every Friday, he would give me a quiz.
So he was your mentor.
That's how I got into taxes. And I switched my major to accounting the following semester. And I became a CPA, yes.
And how did you move from the business world into the academic world? Because you're a professor at CUNY, which is the City University of New York.
I have liked the idea of teaching people things even then. So, for example, in that very first job, they got the first, it's a joke now, mini computer, Burroughs mini computer, which is the size of a giant desk, and they trained me to use it. And then I trained other accounting firms how to use this mini computer with paper tape. And I found that I was good at explaining, and I enjoyed it. It's a great satisfaction to teach somebody anything, whatever it is. You're enriching their lives. And after that, I always took opportunities to teach. And then eventually, I was an adjunct at the college level. Et voila.
This hit me as I was doing research about you. Do you think it's fair to use the adjective eclectic before your name?
Yes.
I was thinking, men, you know, or somebody could say, well, she's a woman with varied interests, but they really go from here to there to there.
Yeah, I've always been that way, and I continue to be that way. I know, in addition to those kinds of things, I can also do web design. It's really endless. It's really endless.
So here I am sitting across from a Renaissance woman. How exciting. I'm honored. So you go to France.
April 2000, I went to Paris. I had made up my mind. I mean, as I got to my middle 40s, I really questioned a lot of things. And one of them was the fact that I had not realized this dream of going to Paris. So I got 3 plane tickets for me and my kids.
Oh, okay.
And off we went, April in Paris. And I didn't know what to expect. I just knew I wanted to see Paris. But it's when and my friends said, you know, you've had this fantasy your whole life. We hope you're not disappointed.
You had never been before?
I had never been. As part of this blossoming in my 40s, where I decided to go to France, I also decided that I was going to learn French. I could always read it and write it, but speaking and understanding was a different thing. So I signed up for a French class about 6 months before we left, and it was based on a video series. And so I wanted to see, so I listed all the things that they showed in the video series, and so we went to see those. It was a wonderful trip. And that's when I decided I wanted to move when my children were grown.
And when you moved, it was at that point that you got very involved with French wines and cheeses.
Actually, for maybe 4 or 5 years before I moved, I taught a French, I can't say cooking class, I would say eating class, a French food appreciation class at the Alliance Française in Hartford, Connecticut, mm-hmm. Where I would cook and bring the food, and we would sit and eat it and talk about it. And mm-hmm. people would bring wine. So I was always very interested and always very interested in food and had been teaching. And it was so much fun that I thought when I moved to France, I wanted to also do something related to food. And at one point when I went on one of my visits, I thought I would like to attend a wine and cheese tasting and realized there were almost no options.
Huh.
And so I thought, well, that's something I could do. So I was working here in the city, in New York City, and I started signing up for every cheese course imaginable. So by the time I actually moved to France,
you knew what you were talking about.
I really did. Yeah, I really did know what I was talking about.
How wonderful. And then to be able to start this business, was it successful?
It was. It was one of the highest rated. I still think there must have been something wrong with TripAdvisor's algorithm, but it was consistently rated one of the most popular attractions in Paris.
Isn't that terrific? So let's move from food to movies. It was that documentary that propelled you to get involved with the research.
Yes,
about
I had always been fascinated with the Louvre, both as a museum, but also the building. It's 800, it goes back to 800 years. And so to me, when I look at that building, I see kings and queens and the ghosts of everything that happened there. To me, the building really represents a microcosm of the history of France and the history of Paris. But I had never read much or written much about what happened during World War II. So in this documentary, which touched upon it a bit, it told a story of one of the it mentioned that the French hid the artwork from the Germans, which, as it turns out, is not true at all. And that one of the things they did to hide the paintings was, one, they used it as a false ceiling in a restaurant in Montmartre. And I left the documentary and thought to myself, well, that sounds really interesting. I would like to find out more about that. So I sat down on my computer and started Googling and did not find any reference to that painting. But the more I found, the more this amazing story unfolded. And that's how the book project got started. And the irony of it all is that never happened. No, the French did not hide the art as false ceilings in Paris.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Jerry Chanel, who is the author of Saving Mona Lisa, The Battle to Protect the Louvre and Its Treasures During World War II. So you start all this research and you find out that there's a lot of misinformation. But it was my understanding that while you were in France, you were researching
The history.
The history.
Yes. I started doing the research when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was during this process that I decided to move back to the U.S. Mm-hmm. after 5 years. And I continued, I was able to continue the research by going back every year and continuing to work in the archives. And what I did, because I only had a limited amount of time at that point, since I was here, not there, is I took thousands of photographs of documents. They were wonderful about allowing the people who run these various archives were welcomed me with open arms. And I took thousands and thousands of photographs of documents with the understanding I had to sign documents saying I would not share anything without their permission. But then it allowed me to come back and work from my computer as mm-hmm. if I were there.
So you knew somewhere in your gut that you were going to write a book?
The minute I started Googling, I think within a matter of days, I knew that there was a story there that had not been told. Parts of the story were written about in bits and pieces, for example, in Rape of Europa, which is a wonderful book, which focused on what was taken. And so what happened with the Louvre was very much a side story. And there are books out there where there's bits and pieces of the story. But that's why I had never come across them, because I had never read books about the art that was stolen. And so therefore, I never came across these bits and pieces. So what I envisioned was a story that put the Louvre front and center and what happened with its art and other French national museums, rather than there. You know, I do recount in the book some of the aspects of the stolen art, because the stories clearly intersect. But there was clearly a book to be, there was a story to be told about the curators at the Louvre and the incredible things that they did, often at risk to their lives during the years of occupation.
I had read that many of the staff at the Louvre were resistance fighters.
Yes, yes. Many of them were in the resistance. And at one point, there was actually tension between the man who was the director of the French National Museums and the director of the Louvre, Jacques Chaujard, because he felt that one of the curators in particular had such a high-profile resistance role. And he, along with certain other curators, were actually stockpiling resistance materials in the depots. And the Germans greatly suspected it, that he told them they shouldn't, but he knew that they were. So that was an interesting interplay between the roles.
Sure. So before we get into the facts, it took you how long to research and write this book?
Well, I had done it in bits and pieces
right.
while I was living there, but when I came back and made it a major part of my life, it was 7 days a week for about 2.5 years.
Wow.
I mean, on top of the fact that I was teaching, which is
working,
a huge
yes.
commitment, and doing my scholarly writing, which I also need to do for school. But it was a labor of love, so I didn't mind it.
How did they save the Mona Lisa?
Well, one of the most interesting things that I found is France is a place where there's been much war, and the Louvre, being in the middle of Paris, has seen much war. And so it was interesting to go back and see at what point they began to think about the fact that they had to protect the art in the first place. And even, for example, in 1870, when the Prussians came, they sort of decided to try and protect what they could, really, a few days before the Prussians arrived at the gates of the city. During World War I, there was a limited evacuation, but again, they didn't plan very far ahead. It was all a bit impromptu. But at the end of World War I, the handwriting was really on the wall, you know, as far as many people believed, and the French leaders figured there would be another war with Germany sooner or later. And so one of the things I found fascinating right from the get-go is they began planning for this evacuation in the very early 1930s.
Oh, so this wasn't a last-minute rush to...
No, the actual evacuation began several days before war was declared in 1939. But they began planning in great detail for how they would do it in the early 1930s, scouring the countryside for places to store the art, considering the transportation modes, how they would get it there. Even in the early 1930s, the archives show that the man who was in charge of the French National Museums at the time was sending out letters to the curators of the different departments and the other French National Museums, asking them to make priority lists of what they would evacuate first in case of emergency. And they created a system, a color-coded system, so that once they had to start packing, they knew exactly what they would take in what order.
Do you think in your research that they moved too slowly, even though they did save major works of art?
No, because throughout Europe, everybody hoped that war would not come. And so there was a point in the fall of 1938 that Europe believed there would be war, and there almost was war until the Allies, I believe, agreed to let Germany allow to take part of Czechoslovakia. And at that point, they began to evacuate because they could see that war, or they believed at that point that war was actually coming. And then the Munich Accords were signed, and war seemed to be averted. This was, I think, in October 1938. And so they started moving it back. So Mona Lisa left Paris, went to the Loire Valley, and less than a week later came back.
Wow.
So it was a bit of a small-scale dry run for what actually happened the following year.
So what happened the following year?
It began to be clear that war would come. And so they acquired thousands and thousands of crates and packing materials. And there were also plans. It's interesting. It wasn't just a question of protecting the art. It was also a question of protecting this major historical
institution
building.
Yeah.
And so there was a wonderful newspaper photograph of a horse-driven cart delivering hay because they had to protect the windows of the building. And that started happening in August. Very intensive preparation started happening in August to get all the packing materials ready. And when the government gave them the go-ahead, they started packing and worked around the clock.
And where did this art go?
Most of it went to the Loire Valley. And what's amazing is really in less than a week, the place was almost empty. Almost 4,000 world-class paintings and thousands of other items.
Objects.
Objets d'art, antiquities.
What about sculptures?
They evacuated everything that they felt could be evacuated given the constraints of capacity. And they had to leave certain things that they believed were either too heavy or too fragile to move. For example, Venus de Milo, they originally thought was too fragile, and Winged Victory of Samothrace, which is at the top of this massive staircase under an arched ceiling. And they originally, it was interesting, architects and engineers analyzed parts of the building in terms of resistance to various strengths of bombs. And
wow,
you could see that all through the 1930s, this kind of analysis. And they originally made a determination that the arch over Winged Victory of Samothrace was good enough. And then they decided it wasn't. And can you imagine moving it? I think it weighs 3.5 tons, 118 pieces, some of which are just plaster reproductions. They put a long wooden pieces and rolled, made a ramp, and it had a giant pulley, and slowly brought it down the stairs and tucked it in a corner that they felt would be more resistant to bombs. But eventually they conclude, within a matter of weeks, concluded they were still too worried, and it went off to the Chateau de Valençay in the Loire Valley.
During this time, was the Louvre open to visitors?
No, it was open until the order was given to evacuate. So they closed at 5 p.m. and at 5:01 they started packing.
Now, did they do this under the cover of darkness? Were the works of art taken in the middle of the night to the Loire Valley?
No, because this was before war broke out, and it was done in convoys of 6, 8, 10, 12 trucks.
And do people know what was in those trucks, or nobody paid any attention?
That's not clear. I would imagine that anybody who, you could see it happening. I mean, there's photographs of the trucks lined up along the Seine.
But I don't know what's inside them, do I?
With all the security, I would imagine, I mean, there were armed guards at the beginning of the convoy, at the end. It was hard to keep hard to keep it a secret.
You mentioned a chateau. Were these going also to some private home somewhere in the Loire Valley?
They settled on chateau because there were a number of criteria that the depots, these evacuation depots, had to meet. They had to have large entryways to be able to get large crates of art in and out. Some of the artwork was packed individually, but some of the paintings, there were many of them, packed together in large crates, and obviously they were sculptures and other large items. So there had to be good ground-level access. They had to be very strong. They had to meet certain conditions of low humidity, and it turned out the chateau, which had stood the test of time.
Been around for generations.
You know, some of them didn't meet the criteria, but actually chateau turned out to be the best place. So they tried to find various chateaux that were not so far from Paris that it would be impractical to get them there, but also a lot of works of art need ongoing restoration and maintenance, so they wanted them to be close enough to Paris where they could be returned if necessary for care or repair, and to allow the curators and the other staff to go back and forth.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Jerry Chanel, who is the author of Saving Mona Lisa, The Battle to Protect the Louvre and Its Treasures During World War II. So where was Mona Lisa taken?
Mona Lisa originally went to Chambord. Actually, the largest amount of items went to Chambord, along with items from many other museums, which is one of the biggest chateaux in France, mm-hmm. and other chateaux in the Loire Valley, except for a few that were a little bit northwest, because they also wanted them to be near each other. So again, the staff or the items could move back and forth. But Mona Lisa originally went to Chambord and was there for a while, and then they were concerned about humidity of the painting. They started to see that the case was warping a little bit. So they arranged to move the painting to another chateau that had better
accommodations.
Climate conditions. But there was an interesting story there that they attached an ambulance stretcher to the inside of a truck to provide some cushioning. Mm-hmm. But they were also worried about fluctuating humidity levels on the ride. And the man in charge felt that he should ride in the back of the truck with the painting. But then they hermetically sealed the back of the truck to prevent these humidity fluctuations. And when I think it was maybe about 100 miles, I don't quite remember, he was almost unconscious when they arrived.
What happened to him? Yeah, oh, my gosh. Yeah. Is it accurate that the Mona Lisa was put into a special red velvet-lined case?
Yes, a custom-made case was made in the fall of 1938 for that short-lived evacuation, and so they used the same case in 1939. I learned in my research that you can't always believe what you read. Mm-hmm. People sometimes are sloppy in their research. There's conflicting sources for any number of reasons. So even though it was clear it was a custom-made case and that it was velvet-lined, I couldn't document that it was red. And I didn't want to write that it was red if it wasn't really red.
Uh-huh. And was red a good color for Mona Lisa?
But I had two of the curators, it was a couple who were married, who were both curators, and they had a daughter who was maybe about 12 years old in 1940. And so she was, you know, old enough to have memories of what happened. And she later on wrote a biographical novel of a young girl during World War II whose parents were curators. And she actually mentions that it was red. But again, it was a biographical novel, so I really had no idea. But I had this amazing opportunity to interview her several years ago. And so one of the questions I asked her, I said, you know, in your book you mentioned the velvet being red. Was it in fact red? And she smiled and said, yes, I remember like it was yesterday because my parents sometimes the painting was in their bedroom because it was the driest room in this one particular place where it was staying. And so sometimes her parents would open up the case and show it to her.
Wow. Now, she was one of how many people who you were able to interview for your book? Not very many.
There are very few people left. Mm. I spoke to her for a very long time. I was able to virtually interview So Venus de Milo, Winged Victory of Samothrace, The Crown Jewels, went to Chateau de Valençay, which is also in the Loire Valley. And the Duke of Valençay had a son, also 12, 13, 14 years old at the time. And he's still alive, failing a bit, not his memory, but physically failing a bit. And I wasn't in France at that particular time, but I know someone who knows him. And so I gave him my questions, and so he asked the questions while his wife video.
He answered the questions while she was
questions.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
And then he sent and then he sent me the videotape. Also, I was able to ask questions of one of the men who was a very, very young resistance member at Valençay during the war. Part of the problem was the French didn't just face the difficulty of keeping the art away from the Germans. They also had the difficulty of dealing with the higher-ups in the Vichy administration because they were collaborating with the Germans. So one anecdote that I love is at one point late in the war when the Germans could see the handwriting on the wall, the head of the Louvre got a directive that said that the head of the arts administration wanted to move all the artwork in quotes, east meaning near the German border. And the head of the Louvre, Jacques Chaujard, knew what that meant. The Germans just wanted it right near the border so at an opportune moment they could just kidnap everything over the border. But he couldn't say no. He couldn't say no to the senior members of the government who clearly were having, it was obvious from the archives, were having meetings with the Germans.
Yeah, in bed with the Germans.
They were clearly in bed with the Germans over the artwork. And the head of the arts administration said, the Germans will be happy to provide the trucks. You just need to tell us the volume of artwork at each depot. So he sent the head of the Louvre, sent a very nice official professional letter to each of the curators saying, please advise me of the volume at your earliest convenience. But what's not in the archives is the fact that he got on the telephone and then said, yes, please send me a report, but double, quadruple the volume. If we make it sound like it's impossible, maybe they won't do it. And then they still kept saying, we want to do it. We need the volume. We're going to supply the trucks. And so finally what he said was, well, you know, I agree. I do believe it should go east, but not to the east of France, as you're suggesting. I think it should go even further east to Switzerland. And I have made arrangements, and the Swiss will be happy to take it all. So that's one example of many, many, many things he had to do to manipulate the situation during the war because he couldn't tell his superiors no.
It's dancing as fast as I can.
Yeah.
How long were the paintings incommunicado, so to speak?
They left in the summer and early fall of 1939, and they started coming back in 1945.
Wow.
Yeah, and not all in 1945. It was a very slow process.
To return them to their natural habitat.
And part of the reason was that even after the war was over, the French were lacking food, they were lacking electricity.
The art wasn't a priority.
They were lacking heat, and there was simply not enough coal available to heat the building.
Ah.
And the Louvre is right next to the Seine, so there's a lot of humidity involved, and it was not safe to bring back a lot of the art until the conditions were right.
You must be so proud of this book.
It's exactly what I imagined it as I was going through it. The biggest challenge was getting all the information. And as I got into the story, I would think, oh, well, there's a thread here that seems to be missing, and I would go digging. And so it was a great satisfaction to dig and find things and then to find surprise parts of the story I hadn't expected. So it gave me a great deal of satisfaction to be able to find the stories, lots of very human stories of the kinds of bravery, examples of bravery of the curators, and weaving it together because it was a complex story to try and tell because certain things overlapped with time.
Mm-hmm.
But I was happy when it was done because I felt like it all fit together the way I envisioned it might.
Well, Jerry, it was really a pleasure to meet you and hear about your life and about this book, which is wonderful. We've run out of time, but I'm so grateful that you came today and shared this story. It was really very exciting and fascinating.
Thank you.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.